Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us is Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia. His articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Salon, and the New Republic. His latest book, just out, is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Walker.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And obviously, the United States in many ways was founded by, I don't know how whether you could call the Pilgrims paranoid, but they certainly had a rough time. They'd been kicked out of England and went to Holland, and then they found them even too fundamentalist there. They booted them back to England, and then they finally put them on these ships and sent them to the New World. When you say that paranoia doesn't just influence America, it defines it. Are you saying it's in the DNA?
Well, I think I don't want to suggest that America is, you know, more or less paranoid than other countries. I mean, I didn't do like a cross-cultural study, but I will say, just looking at, you know, American history, that we've been paranoid since the beginning. I mean, I go back to the beginning of the colonial days. I mean, if there were written records of, you know, Native Americans, I would have, prior to then, I would have gotten into that as well. And certainly the Puritans came here with intense fears of, to begin with, of the Native Americans. I write a lot about the fears of Native American conspiracies, which ranged from just, you know, thinking that the different tribes were plotting together, all the way out to, you know, really absurd cosmic notions about Satan having settled the New World with pagans from the Old World because they were fleeing the spread of the gospel, and those pagans became the Native Americans, and he was guiding them in their attack on, you know, the white settlers, and so on and so on. And then, of course, they also turned the paranoia inward. Most famously with the Salem witch trials, but there's these links even between the sort of fear of witches and the fear of Native Americans and the fear of Catholics. And there's a quote from Cotton Mather in here where he's sort of imagining all of the witches and the French Canadians and the Indians plotting together, and this being the source of the so-called invisible attacks that hit Salem.
Well, it's interesting then, you know, to flash forward a little bit to the Mormon religion, which has a lot of strange New World notions of the Messiah coming here in the period that he was AWOL, and the idea that, I mean, some of the stuff in their theology is, I guess, in many ways science fiction, and you've got Scientology here in Los Angeles, which is a big religious player. Is paranoia and religion an American phenomenon?
Well, yeah, I mean, religion is very central to the American experience, and frequently it gets wrapped up in conspiracy theories and fears of people who are different, you know. You mentioned the Mormons. There are, conspiracy theories in Mormon tradition, like there was the so-called Secret Society of Gadianton. I might be butchering the pronunciation of that was supposed to be based in the wilderness and whose leader had sworn secret oaths and covenants to the devil. But even more than that, there were all these intense and strange conspiracy theories about the Mormons, because just as any sort of minority religion that comes along and looks different, and particularly if it has sort of a different pattern of, you know, families and sexual arrangements, will inspire all kinds of odd thoughts as well. And I actually get into a fair amount of detail in the book about these ideas of, Mormons involved, you know, white slavery, seizing women for their own uses, having, using mind control methods. It's almost, sort of I quoted from a book called Female Life Among the Mormons, which was a bestseller in 1855, and which presents itself as the memoir of a woman who was hypnotized into marrying a Mormon elder, and is, you know, a fraud. It's not a genuine account. But there's a point in that book where the author asks another former Mormon how Joseph Smith managed to master Franz Mesmer's mind control methods before it came to America. And there's this whole story gets spun about how he bought the information from a German peddler and came here, and they were using it to build the Mormon harems. So you know, it's tales of, you know, Mormon assassinations and so on. It's a very, you know, odd part. And I should also add one thing about 19th century Mormon life is that they were, at that point, closely associated with making economic cooperatives. So there's also this economic angle to a lot of the fear of the Mormons at that point, too.
And again, I'm speaking with Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason magazine and Reason.com. He's written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia, and his articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Salon, and the New Republic. And his latest book just out is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. So politicians have clearly used conspiracy theories. You know, you pay due homage to Richard Hofstadter's groundbreaking work, The Paranoid Style of American Politics. How much do you think, for example, the Republicans who use the Bertha conspiracies, you know, the Donald Trumps and et al., do they believe that, or is that just taking a political hit?
You know, it varies. I mean, obviously there are sincere believers, and obviously there are cynics. And I think maybe most important, there are people who are able to persuade themselves of something if it's useful to be believed. And a lot of people forget it, but the birther idea actually originated among the diehard supporters of Hillary Clinton, or first caught on, I should say, among the diehard supporters of Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primaries, when they were sort of hoping that this would be a way to, you know, defeat Obama without, you know, the pain of political persuasion. And then after she dropped out, that's when it sort of migrated rightwards and conservatives leaped on it for the same reason. And obviously, I mean, there's some cynicism to that, but I think that especially after it became kind of clear that there wasn't anything to the story, that nonetheless, you know, people were able to keep persuading themselves of it. I don't see birtherism sort of surviving as a top-down phenomenon. I think it's sort of a grassroots thing among people who, you know, would like that to be true because it would make their agenda easier. And I should add also, because you mentioned Hofstadter, I mean, I give him credit for a couple of insights, but I criticize him as well because I think that, I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but I think his essay, which he wrote 50 years ago, was a product of its time, and you can see some, you know, bordering on paranoid elements in there as well, or if not in the essay, he was sort of partaking of some fears that were in the air. And in particular, he suggests that conspiracy theories, you know, what he calls the paranoid style, are a product of minority movements, meaning not, you know, racial minorities, but, you know, political minorities. And in fact, and this is a point I stress again and again since the beginning, the fear of conspiracies has been at the center as well as, you know, the so-called extremes. The establishment has its own forms of political paranoia as well. They're often not called conspiracy theories because they're the conventional wisdom at the time. And you look back decades later and say, oh, when we were freaking out about homosexuals in the civil service in the early Cold War, that was actually a completely irrational conspiracy fear. But at the time, they're considered conventional wisdom and not called conspiracy theories. And I think that these are the sorts of, that's the sort of political paranoia that does the most damage because when, you know, when something catches on among powerful people, I mean, by definition, if you have power, you can do more damage. That's what power is, right? You can do more. And I think that's worth stressing, and I think that was a point that Hofstadter missed.
Well, I think, though, that if you go back to the period that Hofstadter wrote it, and the McCarthy era, and I recall the famous joke by the comedian Mort Saul during the Cold War that the Russians arrested an American for spying and the U.S. retaliated by arresting an American for spying.
Right.
And that, in a sense, our paranoia creates our own nemesis, that the Stalin purge trials were almost identical to the House of Un-American Activities trials here in the United States. They asked the same question: Are you not a communist?
A bit more destructive.
Yes,
people died. You
were taken out the back and shot, as opposed to have your career ruined. But and then more recently, the response to Osama bin Laden has been this multi-trillion-dollar war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Homeland Security, which has cost us about $1 trillion. And there's no cost-benefit analysis done. They just keep pouring more money at it.
And the fear becomes the justification for that. I should say, just breaking in, since you mentioned bin Laden, that I compare the way that his that he is often presented in the press and all as a sort of, or was presented before he died, as a sort of terrorist CEO, you know, controlling this, you know, tightly hierarchical James Bond style, you know, global network of mayhem. I mean, for one thing, that's not what Al-Qaeda was or is. You know, it's a loose network. At the time that it was tightly centralized, it wasn't large, and at the time it's large, it's not tightly centralized. But this echoes a lot of the ways that Indian chiefs who were sort of, I mean, I quote another historian's phrase calling it the myth of the super chief, the way that, you know, people like Sitting Bull and Geronimo were perceived as master conspirators and portrayed that way in you know, popular rhetoric. And it's telling, I think, that when Osama bin Laden was, you know, finally killed, the code word that they relayed to say that the operation was completed was Geronimo. You know, it's just like one of those great moments of an idea echoing through American history.
Well, I think bin Laden himself, though, has suggested that he was hoping to trigger a paranoid reaction in the United States, and then that they would do the rest. They would ultimately do the damage to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of gets back to the Mort Saul joke that you made.
Yeah, yeah. So what is it then, for example, you know, the 9/11 truth has always dogged me whenever I do public speaking engagements, etc. And it's sort of strange, their obsession with Building 7 and all of this mythology, that almost a religious mythology they built around the idea that Bush and Cheney, in order to rescue their failed presidency, somehow got 19 Arabs to fly these planes into buildings which were already wired with explosives, and which makes you wonder why the hell they bothered to use the planes if they could already mine right. the buildings and demolish them from on the ground. And all of this.
The strangest theory is the one that claims that there wasn't a plane that hit the Pentagon, but then doesn't explain where the plane actually went. I don't know if you've heard or seen that one, but
well, obviously they just go on and on. But I've talked to people like Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, who was in the White House at the time, and what frustrates him is that the truthers have actually helped cover up 9/11 in the sense that Bush and Cheney were culpable, since their first responsibility is to protect and defend the United States, that they exposed the United States to reckless endangerment by not listening to the warnings that were coming from the intelligence people, etc. And that strikes me as an amazing irony, that the truthers are actually helping Bush and Cheney for, avoid what they're most afraid of, which is impeachment. And apparently, at least this is what Wilkerson tells me.
Yeah, although I don't think I don't think that the truthers are taken seriously enough among the people who make those decisions on impeachment to actually have that much influence. You know, the 9/11 truth movement comes up a couple of times in this book, but in the end, I sort of feel like they're sort of a side attraction. That the really intense paranoia that or the most important paranoia that hit the country after 9/11. Was the kind we were talking about earlier that allowed all those, the wars and, you know, laws like the Patriot Act to be pushed through. And that's sort of symbolized by people who, you know, they saw a little sugar or a coffee sweetener spilled in an airport lounge, and they immediately assumed it's an anthrax attack. And I think that there is, I will say this about the truth movement, I can understand the appeal of thinking that, you know, there's been this massive horrible thing that happens that kills these thousands of people, and that the best way to deal with it is just to remove the person that's in power in the United States. That seems like a much easier task than actually tackling the all the ways that, you know, the U.S. is interfering in other parts of the world and angering people and these hard to penetrate, you know, networks of people who are angry at the U.S. and just, you know, the mess of a problem that we were and are in. So I can certainly understand the appeal of that story, but I have never been convinced of it. One point I make in this book again and again is that if even when a conspiracy story says absolutely nothing true about the object of the story, if it catches on, it says something true about the anxieties and the experiences of the people who believe it. So they're all worthy of study, and I look at a whole swath of them. And so I understand the sorts of anxieties that, set off that kind of, those theories. I just, sometimes you can understand the anxieties, but not buy the theories.
So Jesse Walker, again, the author of a new book just out, The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Are conspiracy theories, since they do seem to have a religious connotation, or at least a religious intensity, are they also the result of kind of intellectual laziness? Because in the real world, intentions create outcomes. But in conspiracy land, outcomes create intentions. In other words, you just retroactively decide who benefited from an act or a trauma like 9/11, and then the trail leads you immediately to Bush and Cheney.
I would say that is true of lazy conspiracy theories. Conspiracies do happen. People conspire, right? I have a chapter in the book that talks about, you know, the Church Committee investigations and the genuine abuses in the intelligence community that were exposed, COINTELPRO and MKUltra and so on. I've known conspiracy theorists who are open to new evidence and don't fall into that sort of religious belief that you're talking about. So what you're saying there isn't so much the I don't think that's true of anyone who believes in conspiracies. I think it's true of a certain sort of conspiracy believer. And for that matter, a certain sort of believer in stuff that isn't conspiracy. It has to do with sort of the psychology of belief, you know?
Right.
There are folks who like to dig in their heels and ignore contrary evidence.
Well, but you can see why people are tempted. For example, if I were to ask you back in the Reagan administration, who would most benefit from the assassination of Ronald Reagan, the answer would be the vice president, because he'd become president. And then if I told you that George H.W. and Barbara Bush's closest friends were the parents of Hinckley, then if you're a conspiracy theorist, you'd immediately connect the dots. You know, Michael Hastings, the journalist who died somewhat mysteriously in the car wreck here in Los Angeles, which is still a lot of people have questions about. His forthcoming article in the Rolling Stone is a profile on the new head of the CIA. So a guy writes a story about the head of the CIA and ends up in a fiery car wreck. Slam dunk.
Yeah, I haven't been persuaded by any Hastings theories, but then again, as of yet, but I should say that, you know, I didn't write this book as sort of an attack on, you know, conspiracy believers, and I didn't write it. When I think something is wrong, I say so, but it's really just sort of looking at the stories, looking at the folklore, so sort of seeing this, the American history as a sort of panorama of fears that people have had, and focusing especially on, you know, conspiracy beliefs by people in power, not just outsiders looking in. So I don't fault anyone for, you know, suspecting a conspiracy or investigating a conspiracy. I think there's a problem when, as you said, somebody just sort of thinks qui bono is all you need to ask, you know, that, you know, once you've established that someone has a motive, you don't have to then take the next step and prove the case, which has been, during the American Revolution, that was sort of a typical, approach to, the colonies were rife with conspiracy theories by the colonists about the British and by the British and their agents here, by the loyalists about the rebels. If you read the Declaration of Independence, it is, you know, arguably a conspiracy theory. It's not just saying these are all the bad things the king has done. It's arguing that this is a deliberate plot to undermine, you know, the liberties of people in the English colonies. And what is their evidence for that? It basically amounts to what you were saying, that because these things are being done and have the effect of reducing people's liberties, therefore, the reason for it must be a plot to remove our liberties. Meanwhile, if you look at what the English themselves were thinking, they weren't talking among themselves about how can we, you know, crush, you know, the colonies into, you know, and make them our slaves. They're imagining all these conspiracies among the rebels and wondering if the French are putting them up to it and so on. So, I mean, the sort of mentality you're talking about is very, very old.
Well, Jesse Walker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia, and his articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Salon, and the New Republic. His latest book just out is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michael Scherzer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.